Hello and welcome to Context India. I'm Faye D'Souza coming to you from Mumbai. On Context India, we take the time to deliver a fuller, more considered analysis of this country, its politics and its people. Through four episodes, we're taking a close look at what has perhaps been the biggest crisis India has faced since independence, the COVID pandemic. This week, we're looking at the virus impact on the Indian economy. The pandemic spared almost no country in the world. Some weathered the storm better than the others. But the overall impact has been deep and will likely last a while. In India, inequality and unemployment are at some of the highest levels they have been in recent years. I'll be speaking with Jayant Sinha, a member of parliament from the Bharatiya Janata Party representing the central government, and Professor Ritu Divan, vice president of the Indian Society of Labour Economics. At the close of this week's episode, we'll feature an excerpt from a piece of pandemic art, music created through the COVID months. This week, the artist we're featuring is Aribu, a rapper from South India. I want to place before you two faces of the Indian economy. On the left is what became defining images of the first wave of COVID in India in 2020. Laborers rendered jobless overnight, leaving cities and walking hundreds of miles back to their towns and villages, casualties of a sudden, stringent lockdown. On the right, some of India's richest people. As the world grappled with the pandemic, India added 38 billionaires to its 2021 rich list. Two sets of images, two very different realities. But one story, that of inequality in India, exacerbated by the pandemic.
During the pandemic, inequality became absolutely obscene in this country. This is part of the global trend. But in India, the super rich added enormously to their wealth. Let me just give you a few data points. The richest man of this country, Mukesh Ambani, was making so much money every second that an informal sector worker would have needed 3 years of work to make the amount of money that Mukesh Ambani made in 1 second. So it's really obscene and I would say morally untenable.
The number of billionaires, it's a challenge, surely. And the impact on the weaker segment is also a challenge. Government is appraised of these challenges. But as far as my analysis is there, majority of increase in wealth of the billionaire is because of increased valuation in the stock market. But for the weaker sections, COVID has been a challenge, and government through its various schemes has tried to support the bottom strata of the population, and we are looking into it.
The gaping inequalities in India are not new. They're the result of decades of economic problems. But the virus has aggravated each and every one of these conditions. Let's talk about some of the big ones, starting with employment. At the end of the first year of the pandemic, 2020, figures compiled by the International Labour Organization showed that India's unemployment rate was at 7.11%, the highest the country had seen in the last three decades. When the second wave of COVID exploded in April 2021, jobs took another massive hit. According to the Centre for Monitoring Indian Economy, within the first half of the year, more than 25 million people fell into unemployment. But it wasn't just the numbers that were significant. It was the kind of jobs being lost.
Let's take the case of April 2021. 3.4 million salaried jobs were lost in April 2021. What were they? They were mostly medium and small-scale enterprises shutting down. And as they were shutting down, their salaried employees were losing jobs. Now, those people are not going to get them very easily back. Whereas if you were pushing a cart, it could be a carpenter, it could be a vegetable selling woman, it could be a person who's doing a gig in the modern economy. All these people, when the unlocking happened, they went back to work, got lower wages, but they were back to work. Not like the salaried people who were hit pretty badly. So it's very difficult for salaried people to get their jobs back. And that's a severe structural hit.
Now, the policies announced by the Modi government to shore up the economy appear sizable.
विश्व की आज की स्थिति हमें सिखाती है कि इसका मार्ग एक ही है, आत्मनिर्भर भारत।
The headline program Atmanirbhar Bharat or Self-Reliant India stimulus package consisted of three installments of government aid amounting to a total of 14.35 trillion rupees, approximately $193 billion. That's nearly 10% of India's 2019-20 GDP. In addition, there have been specific measures targeting the poor and the vulnerable, programs enabling access to cash aid as well as food grain. But while the monetary sums in the official announcements have been staggering, disbursement of actual money that reached the hands of those who needed the most has raised questions.
If you're looking at Atmanirbhar Bharat, these were notional numbers, and they were also not targeted well. I think during the pandemic, it would have been important to actually invest much more in direct cash transfers or directly boosting up the health infrastructure. But there were also other problems. One of the problems is that it talks of investment in boosting the social infrastructure through the participation of private sector. It sounds good, but if you just announce a package in which you're giving huge amount of resources to the private sector, it will end up again lining the pockets of the rich people and creating some kind of infrastructure for the rich people. But the poor will not benefit from it.
There are three important allocations in Atmanirbhar Bharat. One large allocation was to the poor segment and bottom strata of the population. Direct fund transfer to the rural area, farmers, people who have lost their jobs, and those who need free rations, etc. Second is the part where fund is being given and supported to the agriculture economy, medium, small and micro enterprises and street vendors. And the third portion is about the large industries and big corporate, etc. So the Atmanirbhar Bharat is very well segregated into these three.
The government's programs, notwithstanding, the state of India's middle class and poor worsened considerably as a result of COVID-19. This is not a phenomenon exclusive to India, but the magnitude of the slide in this country was in a class of its own. Years of progress that India had made in addressing mass poverty has been reversed. Two studies that came out in the first half of 2021 bear that out. A report published by the Azim Premji University in Bengaluru showed that in the first year of the pandemic, 230 million Indians were pushed below an earnings threshold of 375 rupees a day. That's $5.12. Had the pandemic not happened, it had estimated that 50 million Indians would have in fact emerged from under this limit. The second report was by Washington DC-based Pew Research Center. Two figures were of particular note. The first was India's shrinking middle class, estimated to have contracted by 32 million in 2020, compared with the number it may have reached if the pandemic had not happened. The second figure was of India's extremely poor, those living on incomes of less than $2 a day. This demographic is estimated to have increased 75 million, accounting for nearly 60% of the global increase of poverty in the first year of the pandemic. The pandemic slammed into an economy that was already on shaky ground years before 2020. The coronavirus made a difficult situation much more so. And how the Indian government addresses this is something that will be watched around the world. After all, India is home to 17% of the world's population. It's the sixth largest economy in the world, and how it fares will have an impact on the global economy. I'll be speaking with Jayant Sinha, Member of Parliament with the Bharatiya Janata Party, representing the central government, and Professor Ritu Divan, noted economist and Vice President of the Indian Society of Labour Economics. Welcome to both of you, and I thank you for your time. My first question, Mr. Sinha, the BJP has always cast itself as good for business and good for economics. In your opinion, do you believe that the BJP has in fact been good for our economy?
The BJP has been wonderful for India's economy, and the business sector is booming despite the COVID pandemic. The reforms that we undertook In terms of GST, the insolvency and bankruptcy code, the monetary policy committee, the social security programs that we implemented, as well as the massive build out of infrastructure, have all made a huge difference. And the net result of all of this has been that we have seen that the corporate sector has flourished. Revenues have grown strongly, profits have grown strongly, and of course, the stock market is at record highs right now. We have the third largest startup ecosystem in the world, so this bodes extremely well for the future. And I'll conclude by saying that India is well on track to achieving its $5 trillion GDP target.
Professor Devan, do you agree that the BJP has been good for our economy?
Well, I'll agree with the question that yes, the BJP has been good for the corporate sector, but only for the corporate sector and not for anybody else in the country. We have had the lowest from 2016 onwards, the lowest GDP rate of 4%, the highest unemployment in 45 years. So, when we talk about growth, I mean, there's no concept of development here. There's no concept of people where this is concerned. And there is no indicator on which India has not fallen in global ranking. You take nutrition, you take health, education, gender, water pollution, press freedom. And now at the Global Hunger Index, we are even below Nepal and Bangladesh and below Pakistan. So really, what is this kind of economic policy which just focuses on a very tiny percentage of people and forgets the citizens of the country? So I think these are the fundamental issues really which characterize whether a nation is growing or collapsing.
Mr. Sinha, let me take that back to you. Pew Research Center this year said that India has added 75 million people to its extremely poor category. And we account now for 60% of the global increase in poverty. Would you say that this inequality is not necessarily entirely a problem of the pandemic and it is a problem of badly managed economics?
I think we have to wait for the official statistics on all of this before we come to any conclusions. The numbers that you're quoting come from unofficial sources that have yet to be validated.
I just wanted to ask you, what official numbers would you wait for? Because
we have to look at the official numbers. We have to see what the World Bank, the IMF and other such international agencies and our own statistical agencies are saying before we jump to any conclusions. Now, I'll tell you, because I'm an elected member of parliament from the Lok Sabha, and my job is to go to our remote villages, go to all the poorer areas of our country, to our of my constituency, that if you look at the benefits that we have delivered in every village, in every house in India, whether it is bank accounts, whether it is water, whether it's electricity, whether it is pakka roads, whether it is pakka houses, you can see the difference in even our remote villages in the quality of life and in the quality of services that people are getting. Right now, we are running the world's largest food distribution program. If you ask yourself whether we've been able to provide better, higher quality services to the people who really need it through the COVID pandemic and even earlier, you'll find that we have been able to deliver these basic services, gas cylinders, electricity, bank accounts, far better than any other government in the past.
Taking the question to Professor Devan, do you believe that the government managed its stimulus well during a moment of crisis?
Well, first of all, I think we need to argue and discuss this debate as economists. And when we talk about data, I think there's and this is something which is very accepted and, talked about throughout, whether it's the academic world or outside or even within the government, is that there is just no data. Your empirical experience is very different from the empirical experience which we have. The stock market is no indicator, absolutely no indicator of growth or development or the rights of people or anything. You know, in the parliament, there were questions. How many migrants? No data. How many deaths during COVID? No data. How many child marriages after the pandemic? No data. These are all responses within the parliament. There is no effort to collect data. A lot of us, whether it's institutions or individuals or universities or organizations, civil society, we have to fill in the gap. And please remember that the pandemic came in a state of when the economy was collapsing. It's very clear that the impact, the negative impact of the pandemic is not so much of the pandemic itself, but the policy response or the lack of a policy response, the compassionate and an ethical policy response to what the pandemic has brought about.
The first point that Professor Devan raised was that no data has been provided. That's utterly untrue. The fact is that, of course, prior to COVID, all of the official statistics were being released. Of course, everything has been delayed because of the COVID pandemic. One of the numbers that she quoted, which is the second point I want to respond to, is that the economy was not doing well prior to COVID. That is also not true. The high frequency indicators were showing a very good recovery. Things were moving along quite well. It's COVID that interrupted that very smart recovery that was going on. So that's point number two. Point number three, that we've had a very good V-shaped recovery, that we are almost back to pre-COVID levels. And hopefully once the vaccination, which of course is also proceeding very well, then we will be able to resume our growth. And in fact, I have written several articles on this topic saying that we are likely to see a repeat of the roaring 20s that we saw a century ago.
Professor Devan, I'll take that question back to you about relief schemes being implemented.
I think the basic indicators which we have to see is from people's point of view and not from the business point of view or the corporate point of view. So are people getting enough food? Are they getting enough employment? What are their wages? Have the wages fallen or not fallen? I think these are the fundamental indicators which we really need to talk about. Now, the stimulus package is primarily for the supply side. It's a demand side. It's only demand which can really increase the growth component. Otherwise, you keep producing and people don't have the money. So what is being produced and what is being purchased? Now, after a lot of appeals by NGOs and by civil society and human rights organizations, workers' organizations, etc., direct transfer of free food, free in quotes. Okay, I'm saying this in quotes. Rice and wheat was to be given, but in limited quantities, in for payment at some point of time in certain states in particular, and with a lot of conditionalities. That is no justification for saying that we were back on the trajectory of growth.
I thoroughly disagree with that. I'm not a labor economist. I don't study what is happening across the country because I'm a politician. I can tell you what is happening in Hazaribagh and in Jharkhand because I have visited these PDS stores myself and I have myself given out, you know, rations to people to make sure that this is happening properly. And what I've heard is, by the way, that it's actually going quite smoothly. The government has said, please do not prevent anybody from getting food grains. Make sure the food grains are distributed.
Mr. Sinha, travel with me to the villages. Forget the villages. Come to the urban areas. Come to the slums. Come with me, not as a politician, not as a BJP politician, as an ordinary researcher. It's a different world.
Mr. Sinha, even though we're running out of time, there is something I must ask you, and this is about the Prime Minister's CARES Fund or the PM CARES Fund. In March 2020, the government launched a fund soliciting donations from India and overseas to help India fight COVID. After repeated petitions for clarity in our courts and on various other platforms, Indian citizens are now told that the PM CARES Fund is not a government fund and therefore does not have to disclose the size of the fund or any of its expenditure. How is this, Mr. Sinha, appropriate?
In a democracy like ours, it is entirely within the legal framework to establish funds which are not government funds, that are NGO funds or that are funds of various kinds that can be used for charitable purposes. Everything that has been done for PM CARES has been done as per the legal framework that we have in our country.
The PM CARES Fund, you say, is not an official program. It's hosted on an Indian government website. It has the Prime Minister's face on its website. The Prime Minister is the ex-officio chairman of the fund. The Ministers of Defence, Home Affairs and Finance are the trustees of the fund. The website says it was created by the Prime Minister's office. How can this not be a government fund? And also, when donations were being solicited into this fund, the citizens were never told that this was not a government fund and this would be a private fund with zero accountability to the public.
Absolutely.
I have complete confidence that whatever has been done taking into account all of the appropriate legal protocols and all of the appropriate procedures and requirements of running a fund of this kind, because I'm sure, you know, all these have been worked out.
But let me give you this. We don't know as general public or as the media how much money is in this fund right now. India Spend put out an estimate calculating what corporate entities had declared as their donations into this fund at $1.27 billion in March last year. This was in the first 2 months of the fund. Would you be able to tell us where this money has been used to fight COVID and where is the accountability for this money?
In a democracy, Faye, in a democracy, there are various remedies. If it is violating a legal framework, then of course your remedy is in the courts of law. There's another set of remedies, which is a political set of remedies, which is in any democracy is through elections. If indeed that is not to the liking of the public of India, they can express their views through the ballot box. And there's a third set of remedies, which is through parliament. And we have a very feisty opposition. I'm sure they will take it on if they believe that there are appropriate remedies through that channel as well.
I'd just like to add something here. I think the PMK fund, you know, the lockdown was declared on the 25th of March, 2020. On the 26th is this relief package. And on the 27th of March is the PM Care. And I know our salaries in universities, in colleges, of pensioners, of doctors in the medical institute who went on strike against their one day being cut to be put into the PM Care fund. I think the PM Care is the most perfect example of how India has fallen from a democracy to a flawed democracy.
Mr. Sinha, just on that one point, government employees handed in their wages to the PM CARES Fund. Do you believe that they deserve accountability of how that money is being used?
Well, I also, essentially donated money to the PM CARES Fund, but that was done voluntarily. As far as I'm concerned, I think the money has been extremely well spent. We have seen the impact of it. And I believe that it has had a tremendously valuable role to play during the pandemic.
I have a final question to the two of you. We are seeing faster growth as of the last quarter GDP numbers that did come in. Is this sustainable and has India's economy turned a corner? Mr. Sinha?
Absolutely, it has turned the corner. As I said, we are seeing a very strong V-shaped recovery. We are moving into the roaring 20s. There are four very powerful growth drivers, which is, of course, the fiscal and monetary stimulus that's been applied. It's the export growth. It's the startup ecosystem. And, of course, the fact that people are diversifying the supply chains. Therefore, what I think is we are going to see very strong, sustainable growth going forward. And that is going to, of course, benefit our workers. It's going to benefit all of our citizens, because not just in India, but around the world, we are going to see synchronized fast growth.
Professor Devan, same question to you. Do you believe that this growth is sustainable and do you believe we've turned a corner?
First, I think the growth is in sectors which, will not provide any kind of sustenance and sustainable livelihoods to the people of this country. The only sector which has shown some kind of a growth is agriculture. And that is in spite of the Farm Acts and in spite of the way they're being implemented. So your informal sector has collapsed, your micro small units, which have not got any, even in the last budget, there has been no stimulus. In fact, whatever was there has actually been reduced. In this, the term which is being used is growth all the time. Where is development? We know history has taught us, historical experience has taught us that growth does not trickle down. Even today, people are struggling for food. So what growth is going to come is only when you put money in the hands of people. And that's why we talk about a universal basic income.
All right. I'm going to leave it there. I want to thank both my guests for giving us time, Professor Devan and Mr. Sinha. I thank you for your time. Thank you so much for speaking with us here on Context India. Thank you. And finally, there are a multitude of artists in India who've been creating work through the long months of the pandemic. We wanted to feature some varied languages they work in and the perspectives that they bring. This week, we're closing with an excerpt of a rap track in Tamil, one of the languages of South India, titled Vanakkam Virus. It translates to Welcome Virus. It's been written and performed by Arivu, a 27-year-old singer, rapper, and lyricist. His work is about social justice and deals especially with the politics of caste in India. This track is about reclaiming a sense of humanity amidst the crisis of the virus. I'll see you next week on Context India.
சாப்பாடு போராட்டம் கூலிக்கு உழைத்த கூட்டத்தை மறந்து கைவிட்டு